Welcome to All Sides with Anna Staver. Just before Bria Baker's grandfather passed away, he had some final words for her. Don't sell the land. It was 86 acres in North Carolina that her family had bought and lost, bought again. Baker chronicles their struggle for land ownership along with the struggles of so many Black Americans in her debut book, Rooted. Part history book, part memoir, Rooted delves into the complexities of race, wealth, family, and self-discovery. Baker says she's trying to reconstruct a world where Black people thrive and relish the, quote, fruit of our labor. Bria Baker, the author of Rooted, The American Legacy of Land Theft and the Modern Movement for Black Land Ownership, joins me now. Welcome to All Sides.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for joining us. Today, less than 1% of farmland in the United States is owned by Black Americans, and land ownership rates in the South are worse than they were 100 years ago. I want to begin by unpacking those statistics, and we can start just within your own family. I spoke about the land that your grandfather said, don't sell. But if you go back 100 years, 150 years in your history, that 86 acres used to be close to 600, if I'm correct.
Yes, that's true.
So what did you learn about what happened to the land that your family had in researching this book?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I learned first and foremost that the land that our family has kind of exists in batches by nature of having bought and then lost and then bought again. There have been various efforts to reclaim and hold on to land, and there, unfortunately, not all of those have been successful. But the first of the land was purchased just under a decade after the Emancipation Proclamation was signed. And so I have my great, great, great grandfather, who alongside his wife is able to buy over 300 acres of land in the late 1800s. And so that felt really monumental to me, wanting to understand how he was able to get the money for that land, how he was able to get so much land. But what was really clear was that the land was intended to be always family held. And that land was passed on to his children, one of which decided to deed away an acre to build the first school for Black children in the county. So it was always a very, yes, let's live on this land, let's feed ourselves off of this land, but how can we be in service of our local community as well? But then throughout the mid 20th century, whether that's through property tax debt, whether that's through putting up the land as collateral, but predatory interest rates, meaning that they were often losing it. They were often losing about 80 acres here, 250 acres there, then buying back some acres and then losing them again. When my grandfather inherited land from his family, he was of the fifth generation who was doing that. And he had ended up using his pension to buy back the 86 acres that we now have.
And that is what I found fascinating, is you weave this story throughout Rooted, but it's also an example, a pretty typical example, it sounds like, of Black land ownership, particularly in the South over the last 100 years.
1,000,000%. And that was really important for me to say. I didn't want this to be exclusively a memoir because I don't want people to walk away thinking, wow, I learned so much about Bria's family. That was so interesting. I wanted people to understand that we're a microcosm and an example and a case study of something much larger. And we're some of the lucky ones to still have our land. But there's so many families, so many young Black people who are walking around sort of like, oh, I think my grandma used to have land somewhere, and that trend is an important one to be able to pick apart. And whereas my family's struggle was often with the weaponization of debt, a lot of other families really struggled with land theft and land loss due to eminent domain, heirs' property limitations, outright, racism. I mean, when I first sold the book to One World was the centennial anniversary of the Tulsa Massacre. And so that was really fresh on top of my mind, was just how so much outright violence was used to push people off of their land.
And one of the things that you write about that I found so particularly interesting is that some of the land loss is in part perhaps because of your own aversion or a more larger Black community aversion to farming, to living in rural parts of the South. I was listening to some of the, excuse me, I've got a frog in my throat. I was listening to some of the other interviews that you've given, and you referenced this one survey that I want to talk about where Black Americans were asked if they would pick cotton if they were paid $100 an hour, and that so many of the respondents said they would rather work minimum wage at a fast food joint. And I find that so, I can't decide if I find it like sad or I don't know how to feel about it. So I'd love to know what your reaction was.
Yeah, it was really hard to hear and pick apart some of those mindsets that we've internalized. And I do think it ends up being a byproduct of the land loss, but then it serves to cement it and to sort of like prevent a more robust resistance is what I would say. So I think that ultimately the land loss really is driven by, you know, racism and the consolidation of land and power and wealth in the South. But as Black people are moving north during the Great Migration, there's this push to assimilate into this Northern and Western culture, to kind of shed those backward Southern ways. And I think that speaks to something that Imani Perry talks about in South to America, about our desire to project our disgust and our shame onto the South. And so both, you know, white people prefer to believe that racism exists only in the South, but also Black people got to a place of feeling as though everything bad in this country exists in the South. And so why would I want anything to do with all of that badness? And I think there is an important distinction between saying things that happened to us on this land were bad, but the land itself, the region itself, is not the villain in the story. But unfortunately for so many of us, it has become that, where even amongst Black communities, I hear people saying like, you know, we should just like let them secede. We don't need Florida. We don't need the South. And, you know, let's just take up space elsewhere. But we're leaving so many people behind if we do that, because most Black Americans do still live in the South. And most of our stories in the Americas begin in the South. And there is something beautiful worth reclaiming, but we can't get there if we blame the land and nature and the region itself for what people did.
Yeah, you write about this in your own personal life. You were not a farmer, or you didn't envision yourself as a farmer, and it's not until you meet your partner that you begin to think, oh, maybe I could have chickens.
1,000,000%. And that's something that I never saw for myself. Growing up in New York, and I'm a granddaughter of the Great Migration. I'm one of the ones who takes a lot of pride in being a Black Northerner. And I enjoy certain elements, and I enjoyed visiting the South, but it was not ever someplace where I could see myself setting roots, pun intended. But the more that I would dig into the history and learn to take pride in the fact that my grandparents and great-grandparents and for many generations before them were farmers and landowners, it made me want to explore it for myself and think like, okay, well, actually that can't be that hard. If they could do it, I could do it. I can grow something. I can raise chickens. And it's been a beautiful journey of pushing my mind to honor its capacity, you know? And even that has been part of the journey of this book. When I first started writing the book, I was really focused more on making the case for reparations, which is still an important thread in the book. But I also have learned that I had seen my ancestors and my elders as these damsels in distress when they were very wise experts on land stewardship and tenureship. And they had something taken from them where they weren't able to continue to exercise that expertise, but just starting to see them as such, like farmers as really incredible people who understand how to be innovative with something that should be renewable, but that like ultimately we're racing against the clock to preserve, and to realize that I can learn so much from them about even just environmental justice and that intersection with this topic.
You also write about that holding on to the land and preserving that is an act of activism in a way that you hadn't considered before writing the book. You talk about your grandfather who would go and check on other family members' property taxes, pay them, and then let them know that they had been behind. It's just that decision to say, hey, I'm going to make sure that not only I don't lose the land again, but that like my neighbors, my family keep it as well.
Yeah, 1,000,000%. And I think that goes back to the collectivist mindset. My grandfather was never wanted to be an island of his own. He was always really invested in a community of Black people, knowing where we come from and owning something that reflects the larger legacy we come from. And so that meant, yes, he wanted all of his siblings to still have their acreage and to build upon it for their, you know, branches of the family tree, but even others in the community. He just has always been really invested in the collective us. And I think that's an important thing too, is to not think that the answer is, you know, put up a gate and hide behind it, but to extend, you know, to put the wall sideways, as I believe Angela Davis said, and turn it into a table, a bridge.
When did you know that you wanted to write this story, not only about your grandfather, but about Black land ownership?
I didn't realize it until after he had died. And I initially just started doing a lot of research as a personal grief project. I thought it would be interesting to provide some of this story to my cousins and siblings and aunts and uncles and parents, and just help us all to still feel connected to the land and to the effort that my grandfather had put into the land while he was alive. And at that time, I was also in the process of getting married. So these parallel journeys were happening, both very personally, where my wife and I were getting married on that land. And I was doing so much history and archival research around the land and learning the story. It just felt so naturally compelling to me. And again, like I said, 2021 came around. It's the centennial anniversary of the Tulsa Massacre. I'm preparing to get married that year on land that my grandfather has fought so hard for. And it feels like a really important time to be encouraging other young Black people to not give up on it, especially because the Bruce's Beach campaign had also just been successful and just really wanting to offer up a more imaginative vision for what restitution could look like.
I want to talk a little bit about the Tulsa Massacre, because there is this dispute, I guess this ongoing historical mm-hmm. dispute about whether land theft was part of the massacre. And I was hoping mm-hmm. you could kind of talk about the difference between official and unofficial records.
Yes. Oh, goodness. First of all, it is mind-blowing that that even becomes a conversation in Tulsa, but you're right. It does dominate, because the city on the one hand and the state are so open about the history of the Tulsa Massacre. I went to Tulsa on the book tour, and before heading to Fulton Street Books, just walking around Greenwood, there's a museum, Greenwood Rising, that talks all about the massacre. As you walk down the sidewalk, there are little plaques that tell you there used to be a barbershop here and it was burned down in 2021. There used to be a dry cleaners here, it was burned down in 2021. And so there's this thing that happens where the historians and those in positions of power now in the city will say the massacre did happen. But technically, and it's always the but technically there that becomes so offensive, because then they deny the land theft because there's all these official definitions of what it means for land to be stolen from you. But I just like to make things plain. If a Black family or person had property, had a business, had a single family home that they don't have now, or that they didn't have in 2022, if they were made homeless and were not given anything in exchange to repair their homes, if their business is now occupied by another business, like if they did not have it and it's not because they didn't sell it, then that is theft. And we get into this debate, you know, the same thing is said about the Wilmington Massacre in North Carolina. The Wilmington Massacre is a lesser known massacre than Tulsa, but it got brought up a lot around January 6th, because it is the quote unquote only successful coup on US soil of a American government. And long story short, they also say in Wilmington, oh, there was no land theft. And it's because they can't prove that there was land theft. And this is what they say, because deeds were burned. And so the official archive cannot say this land was once owned by this family, except that you have families who had lived there all their lives, who generations before them had lived there. And then all of a sudden, census records show that they live in Indiana or New York or somewhere that's not Wilmington, North Carolina. And someone else lives in the homes that they once lived in. So I just, the technicality of it all, the insistence that in black and white ink, it says a white person stole it. And I can't wrap my mind around why there needs to be a perfect victim in these situations. And the situation has to be a clear cut where if it's just, if the land was once theirs and at a certain point was no longer theirs, and not because they got to trade that in for capital, that is theft. And I think we do such a disservice to living and deceased victims when we don't honor those stories. I mean, in Tulsa, again, they have the plaques, they have the museum, but you have Black elders who are above the age of 100 who are in and out of court telling their story and are not being given restitution. And the Tulsa, I believe Tulsa just announced a reparations task force and commission, which is sort of like a slap in the face to those who are really been trying to get that for decades.
It reminds me of a story that we recently did here. There's a group of people called the Randolph Freed People. They were freed by a slave owner named Randolph, and not only did he free them, but he gave them money. He gave them money, and he gave them land here in southwestern Ohio. But when they got here, the white landowners were like, absolutely not. You are not living next to us. And they ran them off. And now there is an effort here within our own state to return some of the land to the descendants of the Randolph freed people. And it is so strange to see it in historical newspaper accounts. Like, they get off the boat and they're met by these people, these armed like mob of white men who are like, get back on your boat and go home.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, and it's just so devastating because even like you just said, these are stories across the country. And I think people assume that this is only something you'll hear or see in Alabama, in a deep, deep South. But it is an experience that Black people have across the South, across the Midwest, and in northern spaces. There's redlining, there's outright theft, there's all sorts of ways that Black people are pushed off of their land. And so when we see the stats to go back to the top, how racial wealth gaps are widening just as Black home ownership rates plummet and just as Black land ownership rates are less than 1%. Like, we're doing fractions of a fraction at this point, to describe rural Black landowners. And so it's just all interlinked.
Yeah, Ohio was a free state. We were not a slave-owning state, but it is uncomfortable and it's worthy of consideration that just because we were does not mean that we weren't complicit in some of these things. Like, we literally, like, the state of Ohio ignored the pleas of the Randolph freed people to like collect their land for essentially for it's now been 150 years.
Yeah, 1,000,000%, 1,000,000%. And I think that's another piece too, is just how long the issue has been allowed to compound, and to keep getting worse. And so it's like, listen, if the country had done the right thing during Reconstruction, we might not be having this conversation then. And then if the country had done the right thing in the mid-20th century during the civil rights movement, in response to the civil rights movement, and had a full accounting, we might not be having this conversation right now. But the problem, it's like the principle and the interest, and like the interest keeps making it worse. And so there are just so many families who just have these intergenerational stories of trauma, of loss, of theft. It's very degrading and dejecting, and it leaves people feeling as though, why bother in this country that the moment a Black family, a Black person, a Black community shows themselves like willing to be successful, that there seem to be all of these systems designed to rip that from people. That was even something when I was in Detroit that a woman had shared with me. And it was just really sad to just like to see the look in people's eyes. And it's more, there's a dollar amount that we can associate with this, but it's so much more than that. It's having ambition and pride, and then realizing that it really doesn't matter if the society around you doesn't want you to be successful and to feel at war with your country. It's almost like getting a like organ transplant and your body's rejecting it and feeling as though like I'm trying to be a contributor here. I'm trying to do what you've said, pull myself up by my bootstraps, and you won't even let me do that. You won't even let me acquire this on my own without feeling as though, you know, so that's where the paranoia comes from with so many Black elders. And it's very real, feeling as though you can't get ahead in this country. And that's a really difficult thing to try and fix in people.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to delve into the history of land ownership in America. That's when our conversation with Bria Baker continues on All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
New from The Embedded podcast. Female athletes have always needed grit and talent. But for decades, they've also needed a certificate.
There was chit-chat about, is that really a woman?
And even now, they're still being checked and questioned. Their story is the newest series from CBC and NPR's Embedded. It's called Tested. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We're talking about the history of Black land ownership this hour with the author of Rooted, The American Legacy of Land Theft and the Modern Movement for Black Land Ownership. Growing up, Bria Baker had always been surrounded by her family's love of land, taking trips down to North Carolina to visit Baker's Acres. But your book, Bria, goes even further back, beyond Lewis Baker and his wife Nancy's first purchase of land in 1882, before there were even white Americans. You write that the Americas were just as populated as any other continent. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah. How did you decide that you wanted to expand beyond Black land ownership to the history of Native American land?
Yeah, to me, it felt so... it would be an incomplete story to do anything but to talk about any form of land ownership in this country and to not talk about indigenous land ownership. Felt like I would be zoomed in on one specific part of the story without telling the fullness. And I didn't want to run from that because I think there is this idea of, well, how do we do reparations and land back? And are there competing claims? And for me, talking about reparations necessitates a conversation around land back and vice versa, because to talk about slavery and all of the Black land theft that happened after slavery, once Black people were given the space to own land, requires a conversation about who was taken from in the first place, requires a conversation about how indigenous land theft fueled slavery, because the more land that was taken, the more bodies that were needed to work that land. And so there's this intertwined history that I believe Black and Indigenous Americans have. And there's a lot of beauty in acknowledging the solidarity that Black and Indigenous people have worked together in Maroon settlements, have worked together as abolitionists, have worked together during the Civil Rights Movement. And all of that feels because we understand the histories. Black people are displaced people as well. And even if we are continents away from the land that we are originally from, we know what it means to feel like land is familial and spiritual and ancestral, and to feel your liberation in the land. And so I wanted to start there. I also thought it was really important to start there because when we talk about the land, even the way that Black people had to relate to the land was in this very like capitalistic, let's profit off of it mindset. Because by nature of the way that like the agrarian economy was set up, like the United States became the richest country in the world off of the profits made off of the land, off of cotton, off of tobacco, off of sugarcane. And so thinking of Black people trying to participate in that same economy, but also knowing that the land is being stripped, that this is unsustainable to continue to expect these yields and harvests from this land. But there was a time when that wasn't the case. And so I think that's also important because we kind of talk about American history as beginning with European contact. But I wanted to remind that Indigenous Americans were tending to land as well. And honestly, in better and more sustainable ways, that the land, that there were irrigation systems and there were, I mean, it was like terraced, and that different regions of the country understood how to work with the land in different ways based on the climate, and that we can learn a lot from that. Again, there's expertise there.
Have you been able to trace the history of your own land, of Baker's Acres, beyond the colonization of America?
I did. And that's a really beautiful thing about the South. I mean, there's parts of the North. Being in Long Island, we have Massapequa and places that still honor these indigenous tribes. But the Baker's Acres is originally Lumbee land, one of the largest tribes in the nation, and the largest tribe in this side of the Mississippi. And so it's been really beautiful to learn that. And when my wife and I got married, we did a land acknowledgement that honored the indigenous experience on this land, as well as the Black experience on the land, and wanting to bring both of that in. And we kind of brought it in as like an example of the love that we wanted to bring, that, in, you know, the Lumbee tribe has loved this land. My grandfather has loved this land, and we getting married on this land, it's an extension of all of that love. And we hope that our marriage will be able to soak some of that up from the land.
You know, I really got that sense of love and hopefulness in reading the book, which is, I feel like, a little bit of a strange thing to say, considering how dark the topic can be. I don't know how a book can be depressing and hopeful at the same time, but you do a good job of blending the two.
I am so grateful you're saying that, truly, because I know that it's a really hard topic, as you said, and I don't want to leave people feeling pessimistic. I really wanted people to feel as though there's something more we can do to reclaim a different relationship, that our food doesn't have to be this toxic, that the air and the water doesn't have to be this toxic, that racial wealth gaps are not inevitable, and that there is a lot of hope. And I think that I am blessed to have learned about that level of hope from people like Abell Hooks, who talked about, you know, being from Kentucky and loving the land. Ella Baker, Fannie Lou Hamer. There are so many of our Black writers and academics and civil rights leaders who really got so much from land. And I think that's also something I'm claiming is let's not see the land and only see the oppression and the trauma. There's so much stillness and beauty in the quiet of nature, in the cleanness of nature, in sticking your toes in some grass, and remembering that that's important too. It's an important aspect of wellness.
Yeah, it feels cathartic in a way, because what I found fascinating is when you got married, you posted photos. And if I'm remembering the story correctly, you got a lot of questions about whether you had gotten married on a plantation, whether Black people got married on plantations.
Yes. And that was definitely a thing for me, because I'm like, listen, I am very critical of plantation weddings myself. But typically, there's an architecture of plantations, right? Like there's like a big house on a hill. There's like a, you know,
with the big white columns and the double porch.
Exactly. Yeah. The antebellum sort of. And I'm just like, in my wedding photos, it's just seas of land. Like all you see is green. And we have like a tent under the reception for the reception. But the ceremony was just outdoors with just the trees. And so I was just like, there's nothing antebellum looking to this except the land being a reminder. And I think that goes back to that meme about like, would you pick cotton if you were being paid? And it's like, being paid to pick cotton is not slavery, right? Like working at McDonald's can be slavery by nature of like, whether you're being, but like inherently agriculture is not inherently slavery. It was an important thing that I wanted people to understand, and that there's a way for Black people to love land and relate to land without it feeling like I'm being a traitor to my ancestors. Like, why would you want to get married in a field? And it's like, why would I not? My ancestors loved this land in spite of everything that they endured on this land. Why would I reject it after they have fought so hard to have a slice of it?
Yeah. One of the other things that I liked about the book was you share not only a lot of personal history, but also a lot of oral history. And you're clear about it in the book, about where oral history takes over for a lack of physical records. But I love that you found like reunion books and family Bibles, and you use it to trace the histories of these people. And how did you end up like going down that rabbit hole of using these, I guess, what we might define as alternative sources?
Yeah, to me it felt I don't even know if I ever considered doing the book in any other way. I knew that oral history was already going to be a big part of it, and there was a part, you know, of course I'm hoping to be able to corroborate as much of it as possible, and I'm looking through various records to do that. But I knew that things that I could not corroborate, I would just explain that in the text, and that it wasn't going to mean me excluding any story because oral history is so important. I also it felt really important to me, the more Black elders that I talked to, the more palpable and the more I understood the fear and why so many hadn't talked about it before. And so I wanted to honor that and never, you know, get someone to bear and like, you know, tell me and divulge the most painful experience that they've had, and then be like, oh, well, you can't prove it. Like, you know, that I just think that there's such a dehumanizing aspect of that, because a lot of the reasons that a lot of Black elders can't prove it is because the records have been intentionally shifted and changed, and you know, information is omitted. And so it feels as though I'm just like rubbing it in their face that their oppressor was smart enough to burn the deeds, was smart enough to not get out there and like brag about what they did, but that doesn't mean they didn't do it. And so I never wanted to disrespect an elder by discrediting their story. There's a lot that can be done to corroborate. And I also think, to your point, there's so many alternate records that are still very valid, you know. Bibles, family Bibles, and like church records have so much information about grave sites and land ownership in their communities. And I think that was a really important record for me to pull into. And then within my family reunion books were very detailed. I didn't end up posting the photos in the book, but I mean, my 1993 family reunion book would literally say on this day in this year, you know, Lewis Baker bought this much land. And if you go to this county's Register of Deeds office and you ask for this book number, it's on page this. Like,
Oh my
it was
goodness.
very detailed. So, a lot of like that was really cool for me to realize that I had archivists and historians in my family who were doing it just for the love of it. Like, they were not selling it. They were not going to publishers saying, look at all this research I have. Like, they were just going to going to the different counties, collecting the records and telling their descendants how to find their way back to it too. So I'm really lucky to be in a family that had those breadcrumbs. And so even when it's like, yes, I'm pulling on a record that is informal and in that, like, I'm sure it was like one of my great aunts went to Staples or Kinko's, like printed this at the time themselves. But like they pointed me towards the official firsthand record, and I could go from to you know for myself, and I didn't have to waste the time trying to wonder if it existed. I'm like, oh, they know exactly where that is, and I can get that, and I have this corroborated. So I do feel really lucky to have been able to lean on quote unquote informal records that did still honor the official archives.
I love that they were so detail oriented on this page, in this book, over here at this office. It is.
Exactly. And even like it was also beautiful too. The last thing about the family reunion book is because, again, this is the 1993 family reunion book, and they didn't do one every single year, but they did them pretty consistently so that the family tree aspect of the reunion book was updated. But what's really cool was outside of the family history, they also contextualized it. So it just really is helpful for me to not think of myself as special, like, oh, you know, I'm this fancy author. And it's like I'm doing things that my family has always done, and I'm just using a different medium to do it. But so the 1993 family reunion book, the first sentence starts, "In 1619, our four parents were forcefully brought from the west coast of Africa to America."
Oh my
And I was
goodness.
mind blown. I'm just like, hey, we're
Decades
talking
before the
about
project.
right, decades before the project, that was top of mind for them. And I think that's important for to contextualize that the project is pulling on something that Black families have been saying. And I think there's this idea that we don't know our history, or you know, it has to be taught to us in this formal academic environment. But I mean, my family was teaching it to each other in between, you know, fried fish plates, that like there is this important history to know, and I now get to pass those stories on in a new way.
Yeah, one of the things I've come to appreciate in the last couple of years is when you grow up and you go through history class and you think of archival records, historical records, newspaper clippings, all that kind of research that one might do, you just sort of assume this is the record, right? This is the history that we have. And over the last couple of years, I've really come to understand this is the history that's been chosen for us. And there's so much of it that we don't know or gets lost. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, do you feel as though in some way that the historical record is political, if that's the right way to put it?
Oh, 1,000,000%. And I'm loving this interview so much, but I love that question, especially because I think that so many journalists lean into that, the idea that there is a way to do this and it not be political or it not be, you know, for it to be impartial. And it's just not true. And I think that's something that I've really struggled with across my career because I'm open about it. I know what my biases are. I know that I write a book and the research has spoken to me in a way that I'm like, there's a clear call to action that I want people to take. But I think there are so many people who have convinced themselves that journalism and writing can be apolitical, and they're just presenting the facts and letting other people do something with it. And the choice of which facts to include, which not to include. I mean, you can say, oh, well, space was the inhibitor. And it's like, okay, but with that limit, you chose to include certain details and to not include others. The kinds of books that get banned, the kinds of books that get heralded, the ones that are part of our common curriculum and that children are learning English and social studies off of, versus the ones that they have to take an elective in college and pay for. All of it becomes very, very political. And I think even the fact that, you know, there have been other books that touch on Black land theft, but ultimately there's this like squashed history and there's not a full accounting of what that looks like. So that when we talk about reparations, the prevailing narrative is this, oh, it's a handout, as opposed to us being able to talk about how the New Deal was a handout for white Americans or how the Homestead Act was a handout. And so we just miss so much of the story by not acknowledging how politicized it is and how, you know, though the conqueror gets to tell the set the narrative, and those who have had life happen to us and who are the survivors are the ones fighting and on the defensive, trying to insist that there's more to the story that is being left out. So I that's definitely, the political nature is really, really important. And it's important to like what aspects of it, like how some places can even still say that land theft did not happen in their backyards when there is no part of this country. Like this whole country should be various different indigenous nations. And the fact that it's not is a product of land theft. The fact that when Black and indigenous people should have had the chance to participate equally, we still were thwarted and still had land siphoned away from our communities is also a proof of that. And we just have to tell the full story, because not telling the story, keeping people from it, is what keeps us in this revolving door.
That is Bria Baker, the author of Rooted, The American Legacy of Land Theft and the Modern Movement for Black Ownership. Our conversation continues when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
New from The Embedded podcast, female athletes have always needed grit and talent. But for decades, they've also needed a certificate.
There was chit-chat about, is that really a woman?
And even now, they're still being checked and questioned. Their story is the newest series from CBC and NPR's Embedded. It's called Tested. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Support 89.7 NPR News with a gift that gives back. Learn more about charitable gift annuities at wosu.org/legacy. Support for WOSU comes from listeners. You can give at wosu.org. Support also comes from the cancer experts at Ohio Health, delivering care that empowers patients to keep making plans. Learn more at ohiohealth.com/keepmakingplans.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. This hour, we're talking with debut author Bria Baker about her new book, Rooted. the American legacy of land theft, and the modern movement for Black land ownership. I want to move into the present day. You're a landowner, a wife, a mother, and the owner of a bunch of chickens. How do you see your children growing up differently than you? Because it does sound like a totally different childhood.
Yes, one may, very, very different. I had a lot more of a suburban, you know, city outskirts sort of upbringing. But I think what I'm most excited about is them growing up with just the space to make mistakes, to be silly, to have a childhood in that way. I felt lucky to have had that, but I think it's harder and harder to have that in cities and in suburbs just outside of cities. As gentrification increases, there are so few public spaces that are designed for people, especially young people. If you are not of a certain age and it's not a bar sort of environment, there are just so few family-friendly recreation spaces that are free and open to the public, and spaces to run around and be loud without someone telling you to keep it down, to be in public space without someone telling you that you're getting in the way. And I think that's an important part of childhood. And I love that he has acreage to do that on. We have our backyard, which is probably going to be the smallest bit of land that he has access to because we have just over an acre. But his grandparents' home has 5 acres. Our land in North Carolina is just more than his eyes will be able to fully comprehend. And I just love that he will have a childhood a lot more like my dad's and a lot more like my grandfather's. Where he gets to fish and he gets to laugh really loud and he gets to climb trees and scrape his knee, but ultimately have space to do that. And I think that, you know, even my wife said the other day, he's never had store-bought eggs because he's only ever had eggs from our chickens. And I'm like, that is so amazing, because if you read in The Guardian, I mean, there's so much studies these days coming out about how bad our food is and how ultra processed everything is. And there's microplastics and everything. And I'm just like, at least his eggs are good. We know what the chickens eat. We know how healthy of a free range lifestyle they get. And at least, you know, the more and more we can get control over what he gets to put in his body, the happier we'll be.
Yeah, I think we just have, we have half an acre and we have a pretty thriving vegetable garden this time of year. And it's just, there's something really nice about sending them out to like pick tomatoes. Although my little one eats them before they ever get in the house, but it is what it is.
And I love that too, that they know what it's like to pick something off and like taste it truly, truly fresh. And to even know what something is in season. Like, I think even that was something that in the research for the book, I was just like, I'm so out of touch with just like, I shouldn't be able to have any vegetable or fruit any time of the year. That's not how it's supposed to be. There is a season for things, and some things are more, you know, resilient plants than others, but like, this, you know, that we don't know what real bananas look like when they're not modified, what a real yolk looks like when it's healthy. And I think that those things are something that when we get to give that to our kids, when they know what a tomato just off the vine, or, you know, when they apple just off the tree, like what that tastes like and without pesticides, I think it's a really beautiful thing.
My kids are so spoiled now. Tomatoes off the vine, they taste so wildly different than store-bought tomatoes.
Yeah. Oh yeah. So they're a little bougie. They're like, wait, no, this is not a tomato.
No, you get tomatoes from like a sandwich shop and you're just like, this is a sad tomato.
Yeah. That's so cute. I love that they know it. The kids are going to be all right.
I think so. But, you know, in the broader conversation, we're living in a time where there's a real pushback to diversity, equity, and inclusion movements. There's a real political conversation this election cycle about these kinds of movements. What has been the reaction to your book in the context of the time in which we are living?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think that the environmental piece has appealed to people, because I think there's been this push towards growing your own food and becoming more independent especially in this context of a, you know, if the apocalypse comes, and in this kind of sort of prepper mentality, which I honestly think is important. I just finished reading Parable of the Sower again, and it, you know, reading that in 2024 is not for the weak, but I do think that there is an aspect, you know, during COVID, the grocery stores were empty and people for the first time were like, oh my God, what? Is my food not grown locally enough for me to still have access to it when shipping is down? And what happens if the grocery store is empty and we still need to eat something? And what do we do? So I do think there is people realizing how dependent we've become on these larger corporations to get food to our stores, to our plates, to our tables, and how that can be really dangerous to put so much power in the hands of a few corporations that control so much of this process. So I think there's that component of how people have really related to it and felt a desire to reclaim their relationship to land. But I also think there's this global energy right now around reparations. You've got Caribbean countries that are seceding from the Commonwealth. You have African nations that are demanding artifacts and jewelry and crowns back from the British Museum. You have, you know, indigenous nations who are demanding their various versions of land back in reparations. And so I think there's also that element. You know, you've got Harvard and Yale admitting to their role in slavery and committing hundreds of millions of dollars, which it really still drops in the buckets of their endowments. But the fact that they're going on the record about their institutional roles, it feels like a tide is turning. And I think there's a lot of Black people who have always joked about reparations, have always sort of been like, we should have gotten that. But it's too late and they'll never give it to us. And I think now there's this shift of like, okay, wait a second, there might be something here and something to ask for, something to demand, something to expect. And I think that that's a beautiful place to put a book out into, because I hope that people can engage it in that more material way, not as like this abstract theory of, oh, one day reparations, but as this like, we're in the midst of a movement for that. And how can we be really strategic as a country in saying that if we do it right this time, maybe we can fix a lot of our society's ills.
Yeah, I will say a decades-long fight here in Ohio recently came to an end. There was a Mound Builders Country Club. It was a golf course built on Native American ceremonial mounds, and they've been trying for decades to get the land back, to put it part of what is now a UNESCO World Heritage Site, and they just agreed they're going to close the golf course, and they're finally making it part of the UNESCO World Heritage Site. But, I mean, I think this has been going on for 15, 20 years, so these fights are long, and they are complicated.
Yes, 1,000,000%. And they're long primarily because how often the court system keeps people, you know, you have to have tons and tons of proof. And you have to, the burden of proof is falling on those who've had these horrible things happen to them. And watching these court systems not really work with people. I think it'd be interesting to see, for example, saying, listen, we do need the proof, but we can invest in, like, we have the records. It's kind of like the way that people talk about the IRS. Like, you know how much I make, and yet you want me to tell you how much I owe. And then if I'm wrong, I'm going to be in trouble, but you could just help me figure this out yourself. And I think it's one of those things where I'd like to see more of an investment on the part of the federal government that knows that there is this larger trend in saying we're going to help people secure the evidence as opposed to forcing the burden of proof onto them.
Yeah, it's been kind of incredible to watch it unfold here with these ceremonial mounds. Like, they line up with the like spring and autumnal equinoxes and like all the chambers and all the mounds, like you can see from one point to the other, and like the light comes through in certain ways. But they're like, no, it's just a golf course. It's fine.
Right. Like, no, like, what are you talking? You know, and even there's like a thriller movie about this now, but Lake Lanier, that's a big example of that here in Georgia, of this idea of like a, you know, a formerly sacred space that is now, you know, low-key feeling haunted by the nature of just putting recreation on the backs of this sort of site. And I think we have to reckon with that. I was reading a book that said that all land in the U.S. is desecrated land. And like, thinking about that, like, this is land that once was everything to a community, a tribe, a family, that had been removed violently and in ways that now we don't even tell the story of it. And thinking of what that does to a people and to a place is really important to think of. And also, like, who needs more golf courses anyway?
So in your opinion, where do we go from here? As a country, as a people, what do you want the future to look like? I guess, what do you want your son's future to look like?
I like that you framed it that way. I want my son to grow up in a space where land is more communal, where he owns a slice and doesn't have to worry about that, but also where there are just more open spaces for convening, more parks, more gardens, more, you know, community farms. I just want that to be the case. I want it not to be exceptional for a Black family to have access to some land of their own. And as far as what it takes to get there, I think we just have to stop running from the truth. I think sometimes, you know, the narrative right now around a lot of the book and curriculum bans are that, oh, you're trying to make some of Americans feel guilty for something they had no role in. And I think what I actually want is for all Americans to feel responsible for our opportunity to make this generation look very different from past ones. And if we just say, oh, well, that's just how it happened before me, and I'm willing to inherit it in that way and maintain it in that way, then I cannot also say that I stand against racism or that I'm here for equality or anything else. We have to actually want to upend things that happened before us and happened unjustly. And I think the more people know it, there doesn't need to be shame. There can be excitement. And that's why I wanted people to feel sort of optimistic in the book, is that there's hard things that happened, but literally every day we open our eyes are new moments to say it doesn't have to happen that way anymore. And we get to say that this is the generation that stopped that in its tracks. And you know, that my son is reading history books about how racial wealth gaps have been on the rise for the last 20 years straight. And that, you know, the divides are getting more and more narrow, and that everyone is suddenly getting healthier and our water's getting cleaner. So yeah, I would love for that to be the case.
That was Bria Baker, the author of Rooted, The American Legacy of Land Theft and the Modern Movement for Black Land Ownership. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.